officially welcome everyone to today's Clue-In Internet Seminar, again, which has been entitled SRI, Reusing Superfund Sites for Recreational Purposes. And today's seminar has been sponsored by the U.S. EPA Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, in particular, the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Jean Ballant, and I actually work in that very same office, and I'll be helping to moderate today's online session. I'm going to cover a couple of basic housekeeping items and reminders to give a few people a couple of extra minutes to hop on the line, and then we'll kick things off. Just a reminder, I did globally mute all of the phone lines, so I've heard from all of my instructors except for Bill Denman. So, Bill, if you're on the line, you'll have to locally unmute to check in and let me know you're there. That means you need to hit #6 and let me know you're on the phone.
I'm here.
Wonderful. Right. Okay, great. So we have all of our instructors, and now I can continue on. Thank you so much, Bill. If you haven't participated in a Clue-In seminar in the past, these are similar to conference calls in that each individual participant has to have a copy of the presentation materials, either printed or open electronically in front of them, and you'll be verbally guided through the materials by each of our speakers. If you didn't already download or go to the seminar homepage to look at the slides online, again, when you signed up, you were directed to the seminar homepage, which gave you a complete description of today's seminar, also included links to related sessions that we've held in the past, gave you a listing of all our instructors today along with their contact info, and then we also had links, again, at the bottom to either download the slides as PowerPoint presentations or PDF files, or you could click the button that says Go to Seminar to actually pull up the slides in a web browser window. I'm going to ask everyone to go ahead and move along to slide number 2, and that'll cover our final reminders before we kick the talks off today. Again, if you're looking at the slides online, you'll want to use the numbered links that appear on the left side. So again, I'm on slide number 2, or you could use the icons that appear at the top of your slides in orange buttons. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. A reminder to everybody on the phones, I did have one caller who did not mute their line, so I have globally muted all phone lines. So for each of my instructors, when it's your turn to talk, you'll need to unmute your phones, and the #6 command will allow you to unmute. When we get to time for Q&A, again, I'll remind everyone on how to take themselves off of mute. You guys, if you're on the phone, can actually ask questions directly by phone, but until then, we would ask that you keep your line on mute. If you have locally unmuted with the #6, you can remute with *6. So again, *6 to mute, #6 to unmute. If you are streaming the audio online, we don't have to worry about that issue on your end. However, if it comes time for Q&A, the only way you'll be able to interact with us is to use the question mark icon that appears at the top of your slides. You want to be sure your pop-up blockers have been disabled. And if you click that question mark button, a new window will open up which will allow you to type up your question or comment. Although we have designated periods for Q&A with our instructors, you are certainly welcome and encouraged to submit your electronic comments or questions anytime they occur to you. And then when we get to those designated breaks, I'll read them out loud on your behalf. Again, each of our speakers will be indicating as they move through the individual slides. You want to be sure to use the numbered links, turn the page, or click those arrows to move forward as needed. Just a reminder, we're on slide number 2 to everyone. I'm going to ask again, that everybody be aware that today's session is being recorded and will be archived in the Clue-In website in about 1 to 2 weeks. You will automatically receive a reminder email from me as soon as that recording is available. And when we're all done with our presentation today, I'm going to point everyone to 2 very important links, one being a resources page where you can download the slides as well as other resources related to our topic, and the other one is our feedback form, which if you're looking to get credit for your participation today, you want to be sure to hang on the line to learn how to do that once you submit your feedback. So that's the end of my official reminders. Again, just one last call again to our instructors. When it's your turn, you'll need to unmute your line using the #6 command so we can hear you. I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number 3. And at this point, I'm going to turn things over to Melissa Friedland, who is joining us here from the EPA's Superfund office, and she's actually the Superfund Program Manager for Redevelopment.
Thank you, Jean. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm the Superfund Program Manager for Redevelopment here at EPA, and today we're going to be talking about redeveloping cleaned up Superfund sites for recreational purposes. We're finding that more and more communities are safely reusing their cleaned up Superfund sites as new playgrounds, as sports fields, open spaces, and trail systems. And this provides residents with much needed outdoor amenities. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Bill Denman, Richard Myers, Chris Corbett, Tom Bloom, and Rosemary Caraway, each of whom are going to talk about specific sites in their region that have been reused to meet the recreational needs of their communities. Just two quick things before we get started. I'm going to remind each of our speakers that every time you turn the page, please say next slide. And second, we decided as a group that we would take a few questions after each presentation, and then we would allow time for questions at the end, so you have several opportunities to ask. But now I'm going to go to next slide. And before handing things over to our speakers, I'd just like to go over briefly how we're planning to spend our time today. I'll begin by introducing EPA's Superfund Redevelopment Initiative and talking about the benefits of Superfund reuse and all the different ways that communities have found to reuse these cleaned up properties. Then we'll hear from Richard Myers from Broward County, Florida, and Bill Denman from EPA Region 4, and they're going to talk about the redevelopment of Davie Landfill in Davie, Florida, into Vista View Park. And then we'll go on to hear from Chris Corbett of EPA Region 3 about the sports fields on the Whitmoyers Laboratory site. And then we'll hear from Tom Bloom of EPA's Region 5 about Reed Kepler Park. And we'll hear from Rosemary Caraway from EPA's Region 9 about the Maywood Riverfront Park on the Pemaco Maywood Superfund site. And then before finishing up, I'd just like to share some tools and resources for getting started with Superfund reuse. Next slide, please. The reuse of formerly contaminated lands is not new. Communities have been reusing cleaned up sites for many years. And while EPA has always been supportive of site reuse, it wasn't until 1999 that the agency formally and officially launched the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or what we call SRI. Our mission at SRI is to develop tools for site stakeholders to help promote reuse and to work with EPA regional offices to provide site-specific assistance. And at the national and regional levels, SRI works with communities, EPA regional offices, and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. Next slide. So for the next several slides, I'm going to share how EPA looks at reuse in the context of providing key environmental and local benefits. Next slide. Superfund's authorizing legislation, CERCLA, makes protection of human health and the environment the central consideration in remedy selection and other cleanup options, cleanup decisions, sorry. This goal of protectiveness is served by integrating consideration of future site use into the decision process. And EPA's long experience cleaning up sites on the national priorities list has shown that most sites will have some future use, and that the process of selecting a remedy that will be protective over the long term must include consideration of what those future uses will be. The more successful EPA is in anticipating the future uses of a site, the greater the probability that the remedy chosen will be protective for those uses. And EPA also recognizes that there are other benefits associated with the reuse of sites. So, for instance, next slide. You can see that this is a Target store up here at the redeveloped Industriplex site in Woburn, Massachusetts. And along with the Target, the site is now home to the Woburn Regional Transportation Center, several businesses, a medical lab, and 75 acres designated as open space and wetlands. Additionally, the site's property value rose $82 million from 1992 to 2003, which in turn translated into increased property tax revenues for the city of Woburn, Reading, and Wilmington. You can see another picture, which is the driving range at the redeveloped Kane and Lombard Street drum site in Baltimore, Maryland. Rumor has it this site is called the Super Fun Golf Course, but I'm not sure. In addition to a safer and more aesthetically appealing property, the site now provides residents with a recreational opportunity in an urban area. And the final picture on there, one of the two softball diamonds at the redevelopment Chisholm Creek site in York County, Virginia. The site has four soccer fields. And between 1986 and 2003, property values within a half mile of the site increased by $31 million. There's a lot of local economic benefit of site reuse. It provides jobs, incomes, and recreational and ecological amenities to local communities. And it may also increase the value of nearby real estate and property taxes. Next slide. Most cities are growing faster spatially than they are gaining population, which results in sprawling development patterns. And unregulated growth, which is often referred to as urban sprawl, generates pollution, heavy traffic, environmental degradation, and a lowered quality of life for communities. So the reuse of Superfund sites can help address these concerns and ensure continued protection of human health and the environment now and in the future. Superfund sites are often located in close proximity to existing infrastructure, including public utilities, water and sewer, and transportation networks due to prior land uses at the sites, which minimize the need for new infrastructure investments. The development of greenfield areas, in contrast, can require the extension of high-cost infrastructure. And finally, the location of these sites within existing communities means that they can provide unique opportunities for infill development and open space within already developed neighborhoods and commercial districts. Next slide, please. Responsible reuse of sites can help to ensure that the remedies remain protective. If a site is being used, it is less likely to become a target for inappropriate or illegal activities, such as vandalism, dumping, trespassing, or activities that could damage a landfill cap. The process of reusing a site can also ensure that institutional controls are implemented appropriately and effectively. Many of EPA's reuse tools, such as ready-for-use determinations, cannot be issued or carried out unless institutional controls are in place. In addition, local organizations using a facility on a regular basis can immediately alert appropriate authorities if repairs need to be made. For example, a local soccer organization may observe that grass needs to be replanted over a portion of the cap. Next slide. Working with communities is an important part of how EPA approaches site cleanup, with Superfund reforms and other EPA efforts focused on how best to do so. And in addition to benefiting communities, the result has benefited the agency on multiple levels. Next slide. Now, in the next few slides, I'll show you a few examples of some of the more innovative types of reuse we're seeing. And keep in mind as I go through these examples that there are so many different types of ways to reuse Superfund sites that there is no one-size-fits-all solution to determining which reuse type will be most appropriate or how to make sure that the site is best reused. Next slide. The Murray Smelter site is a great example of a public service reuse. It houses a medical center, a transit station, and a large retail store. And to facilitate reuse, beginning in 1996, EPA participated in a working group with city officials, the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, or SARCO, and a variety of other groups interested in the reuse of Murray Smelter to create a unique partnership that integrated reuse and remedial planning efforts. By actively participating in the working group, EPA was able to develop an efficient remedy that was protective of human health and the environment and allowed portions of the site to be rapidly returned to use. Today, a portion of the property is currently home to a station for the Utah Transit Authority's Transit Express, a two-line light rail system that provides easier access to Salt Lake City. And also operating on the property is a retail membership warehousing club that occupies 148,000 square feet, and the Intermountain Medical Center, which opened in 2007. The hospital serves as the main referral center for several surrounding states and healthcare institutions. Next slide. From the 1960s until 1982, drum and pail reconditioning and fiber drum processing operations at the former Calumet container site caused soil contamination throughout 11 acres. Ecological restoration and wetland mitigation were important goals of site remediation, and as a result, native plants were selected to ensure the site's restoration to a natural ecosystem native to Northwest Indiana. Once complete, the former contaminated area will be restored as a native habitat and could also provide a recreational resource for the community. Potential recreational opportunities included trails and open space, and the site's trails could also connect with other local and regional recreational areas and trail networks. The next slide. This 100-acre Rose Township Superfund site consists of undeveloped rural property that was used as a dumping ground for illegal waste in the 1960s. And in the 1980s, the site was cleaned up through soil vapor extraction and groundwater treatment activities, which are still ongoing. The site was chosen as one of EPA's 2006 return to use projects following interest from the site's potentially responsible parties of using a 2-acre portion of the site as an experimental site for the development of alternative fuels. So 2 acres were seeded in 2006 with soybeans, sunflowers, corn, canola, and switchgrass. And the harvest was tested for the potential of these crops to be refined into renewable fuels, such as ethanol and biodiesel. And over the next several years, project findings will be used to determine whether these crops can help clean up on-site contamination, which is a process known as phytoremediation. The next slide. So this nearly 500-acre Midvale Slag Superfund site is located about 12 miles south of Salt Lake City, and smelting activities began here in 1871. There were five separate smelters located on or near the site. Midvale Slag, along with its sister site, Sharon Steel, comprises the majority of the city of Midvale's available land for expansion. So the sites presented unique opportunities to create a sustainable community in the heart of Midvale, which is a rapidly growing bedroom community for Salt Lake City. And EPA worked with site stakeholders to develop a reuse plan entitled the Bingham Junction Reuse Assessment and Master Plan. It presented an innovative community designed to become Bingham Junction, which made the most of its proximity to the Jordan River. And the plan called for commercial, residential, and recreational uses. The end result is a large-scale mixed-use development that incorporates major retail and office space as well as housing for Midvale City. Let me go on to the next slide. Aerojet General covers almost 6,000 acres near Rancho Cordova, 15 miles east of Sacramento. And since 1953, Aerojet has manufactured liquid and solid propellant rocket engines for military and commercial applications. But right now, today, the site was added to the National Priorities List in 1986. Groundwater treatment systems have been installed to address contamination, and Aerojet continues to operate with a 6-megawatt solar plant that's been constructed on 25 acres of the property. Aerojet collaborated with Solar Power, Inc. on the installation, which uses large-scale single-site industrial project of its kind in the United States, and the plant supplies energy to power the site's remediation and is fed into the local grid. So next slide, I'd just like to take a moment to demonstrate the wide range of exciting recreational reuse options that communities are putting to use. And the first one, which I mentioned very briefly, next slide, is the Chisman Creek site in York County, Virginia. It's now home to softball and soccer fields. Today, the park supports several teams, ponds, and a county memorial tree grove. And the cleanup of the site also protects nearby ponds, a creek, and an estuary. And the site's cleanup was also part of a larger water quality improvement effort that led to the reopening of the Chisman Creek estuary for private and commercial fishing. Next slide. The Cal Gulch site in Region 8 is home to the Mineral Belt Trail, which is a 12.5-mile paved bike path that loops around historic mine tailings and mining artifacts within the site. And there's a wildlife sanctuary. We have a $1.5 million public sports complex and soccer field atop a former zinc smelter that opened in 2009. And the United States Soccer Foundation, one of EPA's national partners, awarded a grant to develop conceptual plans for the facility. And then the next slide is about HOD Landfill, which is 121 acres in Antioch, Illinois, and it accepted municipal and industrial waste from 1963 to 1984. But today, today when waste management operated landfill closed, the landfill area was covered with a clay cap. It was undeveloped, and there was an uncontaminated buffer land comprising the remaining 70 acres of the landfill property. An initial site reuse discussion began in the community in 1998, and due to rapid population growth in the community and the site's location adjacent to the Antioch Community High School, the community selected multiple recreational land uses, including sports fields, to be located at the site for shared use by the high school and the community sports league. 12 tennis courts were completed, and construction of the site's soccer, field hockey, and softball facilities on 30-acre portion of the site was completed in 2007. And a wetlands area located at the site is being used as an environmental education resource for area schools. Methane gas extracted from the cap landfill also currently supplies heat and electricity, saving the school an estimated $100,000 per year in energy costs. And again, the U.S. Soccer Foundation donated equipment for the new fields, and waste management donates the methane that supplies heat and electricity to the Antioch Community High School. Next slide, Milltown Reservoir. From the 1860s until the late 20th century, the Clark Fork and Blackfoot Rivers area in western Montana was part of one of the richest mining regions in the world. I'm going to skip through here because I know I'm very conscious of time. But let's see. So assisted by a Superfund redevelopment pilot grant, EPA funding the community has developed a reuse plan that called for the creation of a state park with trails, river access, wildlife habitat, and interpretive areas celebrating the region's history and heritage. And all the parties recognized that redevelopment planning could be integrated with environmental remediation and the ecological restoration of the Clark Fork River, which included the removal of the historic Milltown Dam. So today, the confluence of the Clark Fork and the Blackfoot Rivers flows freely for the first time in a century. And in 2010, portions of the site were transferred to the state of Montana for a new state park, and interim redevelopment activities, including several trails and a new bridge, have been completed, a new pedestrian bridge. And in 2005, the Clark Fork Coalition also began managing a cattle ranch on the Clark Fork River portion of the site as a showcase for sustainable ranching techniques. And next slide. Although EPA completed cleanup at the Arlington Blending and Packaging site in 1996, the land remained vacant. For years, neighbors and passerby were barred entrance to the site. It was once home to a pesticide formulation and packaging facility, and the land was now ideally suited to serve as a much-needed community park. There's continued groundwater monitoring to ensure that any lingering contaminants don't pose a threat to human health and the environment. So EPA Region 4 worked with the town of Arlington to develop remedy-friendly schematics for a neighborhood park, and EPA issued a ready-for-use determination for Arlington Blending and Packaging, which was designed to assure Arlington residents and officials of the site that the site was safe for specified types of uses. So Mary Alice Park, named for the adjacent subdivision, opened in November of 2006. It's accessible to all residents of the surrounding residential communities and includes a playground, field space, walking and biking trails, exercise stations, a half-court basketball court, and signs that explain the history of the park and celebrate its successful redevelopment. Next slide. The Jaboom Junkyard Superfund site, which is on the east bank of the Sacramento River, spans 9 acres. The site's a former industrial area close to downtown Sacramento, and the site property was used by Associated Metals for metal salvaging operations. Clean fill material was used to elevate the I-5 freeway by approximately 20 feet, which further enhanced the protectiveness of the site's remedy. EPA deleted the site, and the remaining portion has been successfully reused as a part of something called Jaboom Street Park, which is a destination attraction along the Sacramento River Parkway bicycle trail. Park facilities on the site include a fountain, parking lot, and landscaping. And I just have a few more of these on the next slide. The 160-acre Southside Sanitary Landfill in Indiana was once considered a hazard to human health and the environment, and now the landfill is operating safely and serving as an important source of energy and green space for the nearby businesses and communities. So today, landfill gas recovery wells and an intricate pipeline system collect and transport methane gas produced by the landfill to businesses around the site. And the Crossroads Greenhouse, which is a 6.5-acre glass greenhouse, which opened in 1998, is the major consumer of landfill gas from the site, which grows and supplies 400,000 poinsettias and other plants annually. And in addition, the Rolls-Royce Allison Aircraft Engine Plant signed a multi-year contract in 1998 to obtain methane gas from the landfill. And because methane burns much more cleanly than other fuels, the use of this energy source has reduced nitrogen oxide emissions from the Allison plant by 22 tons a year. And in 1999, a 9-hole golf course was opened at the site, and in 2003, the landfill donated land on the site to the Indianapolis School Board for outside environmental education. And my last but not least on the next slide is the River Road Industrial Center in Fridley, Minnesota, which part of the sprawling industrial site includes an 18-acre parcel of land where solvents, paint, sludge, and plating waste were generated. And the River Road Industrial Center is currently in temporary recreational use by the Minneapolis Piston Poppers Aero Modeling Club. So the site owner and the local flying club came to a conclusion that temporary use of the site as recreational space makes a lot of sense. And while the cleaned-up site awaits industrial development, the Piston Poppers are serving as responsible stewards of the land, and their regular presence is helping to deter trespassing and other inappropriate activities. The club's use of the site is also providing daily proof to neighbors and passerby that the site's Superfund legacy is a thing of the past. So on my next slide, I'd like to hand things over to Richard and Bill to share the story of Davy Landfill's transformation into Vista View Park. And I hope that as you listen to the following speakers, you'll keep in mind all the different kinds of reuse that there is out there and that we haven't quite reached the limit of what might happen in terms of reuse and recreational reuse. So Richard and Bill.
And this is just a reminder, we're on slide number 28.
Okay. Can you guys hear me?
We can.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure I was unmuted. This is Bill Denman, remedial project manager and Superfund redevelopment coordinator in Region 4. The Davy Landfill site, which is now the Vista View Broward County Park, was one of my sites that I managed as a remedial project manager. And we're fortunate today to have Richard Myers with Broward County, who is my counterpart on the Broward County side and responsible for a lot of the great things that happened there. And so I'm going to just do a brief introduction and then turn it over to Richard to tell everyone the story of how Davy Landfill became the Vista View Park. But I just wanted to give a few facts for those EPA folks that might be on the phone and might find interesting. The site was listed in 1983. We issued two records of decision for the site. One was focused on a lagoon area where sludges and grease trap waste had been disposed of. That was excavated, stabilized, and then put in the landfill as the landfill was being closed. And then the other record of decision focused on groundwater cleanup goals. We attained the groundwater cleanup goals and in 2006 deleted the site. But I think the real story here is how forward-thinking Broward County was. And just to let you know, and for those of you on the phone that may not know where Davy, Florida is, it is just outside of Fort Lauderdale. So it's in the southeastern part of Florida and an area that was growing and needed additional park space. And so the county realized this. They knew they had this piece of property, this landfill that was closing, and had the foresight, even before the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative and EPA was encouraging redevelopment, to put in some of the infrastructure as the landfill was being closed that would facilitate the site being turned into a park later on. And so, and I credit this and a couple other sites, but this is definitely one of the sites early on in my redevelopment work that I saw as a lot of where a lot of good practices were used and a lot of great ideas were incorporated and hopefully been able to take some of those experiences and use them at other sites. So And last year, and Richard's going to tell the story of how the park was turned in, or how the landfill was turned into a park, and all the great and wonderful things that you can do there, and it's just too many for me to mention, so I'll let him go through them one by one, and he has some pictures and some discussion about it. But last year, Region 4 awarded Broward County our Excellence in Site Reuse Award because of the great work that was done down there, and went down and gave them, presented them with our award and certificates to those people who had participated in the construction of the park, and it's a really good story and a really good park. So if you're ever down in the Davy area, look up Vista View Park and go out and take a look at it. It's certainly something to see. So without any more discussion, I guess I'll turn it over to Richard. Again, this is Richard Myers. He's with the Broward County Solid Waste Department, and Richard, take it away.
Thank you very much, Bill. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can. And just a reminder, be sure to announce the slide number that you're on.
Okay, so just to continue with the discussion that Bill had, my name is Richard Myers. I'm with Broward County Solid Waste Operations Division, and we're going to talk about, as Bill mentioned, the Davy Landfill, really the conversion to Vista View Park. It's located in Broward County, Florida. And we're on slide 29, moving to 29. And as Bill said, the Davy Landfill, which we now call Vista View Park, is located in the town of Davy in Broward County, approximately 5 miles west of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Next slide. The site, the landfill site was 210-acre site. It was operated as county landfill for 23 years, from 1964 to 1987. In 1964, the site commenced operations as an incinerator and with a municipal solid waste landfill, and it was taking in municipal solid waste for the county, one of two large landfills and incinerator sites in the county. On site, it was accepting ash from the incinerator as well as construction and demolition debris. The total landfill footprint was about 68 acres. However, in 1975, the incinerator closed down due to more stringent air regulations, and a sanitary landfill to take in municipal solid waste was constructed to the north of that 68-acre landfill. The sanitary landfill was 48 acres in size, and it was, again, constructed to take in the municipal solid waste. All of the other waste materials were still going to the 68-acre landfill to the south. Between 1971 and 1981, a basin area at the landfill was used as a sludge lagoon for the disposal of grease trap, pump-out material, septic tank sludge, and treated municipal sludge. And this prompted the site being placed into the Superfund or National Priorities List. And again, in 1981, the sludge lagoon was closed after sludge disposal became a concern regarding groundwater contamination. Ultimately, the site, the landfilling operation, ceased operations in 1987. And just going back, in 1975, the incinerator did shut down. So it was only a landfill operation from 1975 through 1987. In 1995, engineering controls were in place, and long-term care and monitoring, and a permit was issued by the state of Florida, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. By 1995, the county incorporated all of the features of the initial park concept. In 2003, it took a few years, but in 2003, the park opened as a county regional park, and 7 years later, there was an expansion constructed to the park to the south. An additional 61 acres was added, bringing the total acreage to about 271 acres. Okay, let's move on to the next slide. As far as site cleanup, and Bill covered some of it, but the contaminants, there were contaminants found in the sludge lagoon, as in the sludge as well as the surrounding soils. As far as groundwater contaminants of concern, vinyl chloride and antimony were the primary contaminants of concern in groundwater. As Bill mentioned, there were two records of decision for two operable units on site. The first one was the source control of contamination from the sludge lagoon, and the second was basically identifying any additional hot spots and any remediation required for groundwater. Major cleanup elements as far as the operational unit one or the sludge lagoon was excavation, dewatering, and stabilization of the sludge lagoon contents. All of those contents were placed in the municipal solid waste landfill in our cell number 14, and ultimately a cap was placed over that at the time. It was a bentonite clay cap that was put in place. The second record of decision for the operable unit number two was issued in 1994. And the major cleanup elements were natural attenuation of groundwater. The contaminants of concern, again, were vinyl chloride and antimony. And there was also monitoring of residential private wells, potable wells, to determine any impacts upon those wells. And also public water supply connections were made for residents that had been affected by any potential contaminants in excess of the performance standards for each of those particular compounds. Moving on to the next slide. So talking about the path to reuse, in 1987, when the Broward County and the town of Davie realized that the landfill needed to be closed and they began discussions on how to reuse the land, Broward County was at the time one of the fastest growing areas in Florida, and there was a growing demand for new park and recreational facilities. And again, Broward County and the town of Davie, as well as local stakeholders, began the process of transforming the landfill into Vista View Park in the late 1980s, shortly after the landfill closed. They developed a master end-use plan that included detailed analysis and inventory of existing parks and a consideration of countywide recreational needs and goals. And throughout the planning, design, and construction of the park, diverse stakeholders were involved in the process, including regulatory agencies, public officials, local residents, and public interest groups. Moving to the next slide. So, as I said, the initial park, County Regional Park, opened in 2003. The amenities on site included two picnic shelters, a fishing dock, paved trails, horse trails, restrooms, an airstrip for model planes. and paraglider pilots, and a lookout area at the top of the south mound, or the larger landfill, the 68-acre landfill. In 2010, as I mentioned, there was an expansion constructed, 61 acres to the south, was purchased previously, and it was constructed that adjoins the site and included two playgrounds, basketball courts, 7 more picnic shelters, fitness stations, boat rentals, equestrian corral, and primitive camping areas, as well as additional parking. Moving on to the next slide, I'm going to show you a few just pictures of the site as it exists today. And this is a photo of some of the paved walking trails that we have on site. Next slide. Just a shot at the top of our south landfill area, a horse trail that exists on that landfill. Next slide. Just a photo of where the airstrip is for the model planes. I know that they're electrically powered planes, and there's a local flying club that uses the site for that purpose. Next slide. Just one of the pictures of the many picnic shelters that exist on site. The next slide. Camping area and open space that's actually located on the south mound at the site. Next slide. A picnic area, typical picnic area. Again, this is on the south landfill mound, and it's about 65 to 70 feet above the surrounding area, so you got a great view looking out. Next slide. Just a picture of where one of our fishing docks are. It's a catch and release fishing situation, and there are 2 fishing docks. There are also paddle boats that are rented for users. Next slide. We've got just a shot of some of our paragliders that utilize the site. Next slide. And of course, we have not only biking competitions, but we also have running races as well. They use both of the landfill mounds for that purpose, and I understand that they've been extremely successful with that over the last few years. Next slide. This just is a site plan view of the entire property. You can see how developed the area is, really surrounding the entire site. You can see the north mound area to the top of the aerial. Just to the south of that, you can see some trails which are on the south mound area, and again used for horseback riding. And then, of course, to the south of there is the expansion area, the 61-acre expansion area. And you can probably make out numerous picnic shelters and the fitness trail and lots of additional parking. And, of course, there's fishing and so forth on site. Moving to the final slide. To conclude, the initial conversion to the park afforded the opportunity to expand the park beyond the original landfill site. So by converting that original 210 acres, it allowed the county to take advantage of the site to the south to purchase the additional 61 acres to provide more open space and more recreational use area. Certainly the conversion from the landfill changed the site and converted from a negative stigma as a landfill facility to just a very beautiful regional park. And every day we're seeing increased usage. It's amazing to see especially after the 2010 expansion of the park. Obviously brings a great value to our community with such a large area and all the additional uses that the site has brought recently. And most importantly, it continues to be protective of human health and the environment. The facility is maintained as a park, a county park, just like all of our other county parks. So it's very highly maintained facility. And we're also in compliance with the state of Florida long-term care monitoring permit, which requires us to continually sample groundwater and our leachate that's generated on site. So that's kind of where we are with the site. And I guess we can entertain any questions or a couple of brief questions before we move on to the next presentation.
Thank you.
Okay, great. If you're on the phone lines and you have a question, you're welcome to take yourself off of mute. You may need to hit #6 and then either identify yourself and your organization to ask your question.
Okay, and then we'll have an opportunity at the end to ask questions too.
And I don't see any electronic questions coming in either at this point. This is just a reminder, though, if you are streaming the audio, you want to use that question mark icon. Click that, and a new window will pop up to let you type up your comments or questions. You can type those up at any time, and at the designated breaks, we'll read them out loud to address your question. So I think in the interest of time, we're going to move on, but if any other questions do pop up related to this topic, we'll have time to cover them at the end. So I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number 45.
Chris Corbett.
Yeah, hello, I'm Chris Corbett. I'm the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator for Region 3 and also the past RPM for the Whitmore Laboratory site. Move to slide 46, please. The Whitmore Lab site is located in Lebanon County, Pennsylvania, occupies 22 acres in a rapidly developing rural residential area. The company had previously manufactured veterinary pharmaceuticals beginning in 1934 until the facility was abandoned in 1984. Arsenic compounds were produced and stored at the site, which has featured 17 buildings, 23 storage tanks, a large storage vault made out of concrete that was about 60 feet by 75 feet, 15 lagoons, and a waste pit, among other things. Contamination was noted as early as 1964 in the soils, the groundwater, and the surface water. And the lagoon sludge was placed in the concrete vault, which was built during that time to store this highly contaminated material. Average arsenic concentration in the waste groups were in the percent level, typically from 9 to 18%. And the drummed waste that was also placed in the concrete vault contained a highly toxic semi-volatile known as aniline. If you had aniline on your skin, it would immediately take the oxygen out of your blood so that your lips would turn blue, your fingers would turn blue, and it was routine that people that worked at this facility would wind up in the hospital, usually a couple people every month, while it was in operation. So, The point I was trying to make is that it was, you know, some very highly toxic material there that was widely known in the community for a number of years. Next slide, please. Beginning in 1988 and 1989, EPA started a removal action which eliminated the drums and laboratory chemicals from the abandoned facility. Beginning in 1993, the remedial program took over and initially focused on decontaminating and demolishing the 17 deteriorated buildings on site. About 500 tons of hazardous material was removed from the buildings, and the demolition and disposal was completed in 1996. Beginning in 95 and 96, EPA eliminated the problem with the vault by removing 3,700 tons of sludge and sending that off-site to stabilization. An additional 600 drums were treated and disposed off-site, and 1,400 tons of soil were excavated from the vault and stabilized in 1998. During 1997 and 1998, the groundwater treatment facility was built, and then as that ended in 1998, going into 1999, 10,000 tons of hazardous material was taken out of the lagoon area. An additional 28,000 tons of hazardous soil was removed from the site beginning in 1999 and ending in early 2002. The lightly and moderately contaminated soil remained on the site and was covered with a 2-foot soil cover. So basically, we had continuous construction for about 8 years out at the site. Next slide, please. The two responsible parties funded this $75 million cleanup, in addition to having to operate the groundwater treatment plant and conducting the operation and maintenance. So to minimize their indefinite long-term O&M costs for the capping area, the PRP was willing to go beyond the minimum cleanup measures to fully prepare the site for future use. As I said before, it's in a rapidly developing area in Lebanon County. It's near several local schools, and Jackson Township, although initially was not interested in taking over the site, we eventually convinced them that it would be worthwhile for them to take over ownership. We had many public meetings throughout the 8 years because we did 3 ROD amendments and 3 ESDs, and then we threw in a couple of extra public meetings as well. So we were meeting with the township and local officials at a minimum of once a year, usually about once every 6 to 9 months, it seemed. And as they observed the cleanup, because we took videos of the cleanup as it was progressing, we eventually built their trust and showed the township that this property could be used in the future. However, they were very concerned about liability. And because of that, they were fairly insistent upon receiving a prospective purchaser agreement from EPA. And it was at the time when we were phasing out doing PPAs, although we were able to convince our management and the attorneys here that it was necessary. EPA played an important role in brokering this arrangement, providing the vision for the potential reuse and getting the trust and acceptance that this highly contaminated site could be safely reused. During the cleanup, the PRPs installed infrastructure to support recreational use, including sewer, electric, and water lines, as well as the foundation for a concession stand, walking trails along the stream, and added attractive landscaping. We also involved the U.S. Soccer Foundation to visit the site to ensure that the grading of the area would still allow soccer fields to drain properly. Next slide, please. So we were able to convert the site into 4 different soccer fields, as well as a baseball field and a playground area and walking trails. The recreational park opened in 2005. And it's used by many community members as well as the nearby middle school and high school. The township has successfully maintained the site's remedy, and the activity on site deters potential trespassers. Annual meetings with the township ensures their future plans for the facility will not damage the soil cover, and the PRP maintains the cover from burrowing animals, which do live along the stream and dig down in through the 2-foot soil cover, potentially exposing contaminated soils beneath. So there is certainly maintenance that has to be performed throughout this time, as well as a continuing dialogue with the township to ensure that they don't do anything that would disturb the 2-foot soil cover. So as I noted before, although the hazardous soils were taken off site, the lightly and moderately contaminated are still below that 2-foot soil cover. So there's always the concern about the potential recontamination of the surface. Over the last several years, a number of residences surrounding the property have increased significantly, and EPA remains in contact with the township regarding the site status, and we also are involved with overseeing the continuing groundwater cleanup. And that does it for my presentation. Are there any questions?
Again, if you're on the phones, you can simply hit #6 to unmute or ask your question. We did have one question that came in online. This came in from Tucson, Arizona, and they ask, did you collaborate with land planners or landscape architects? They also like to know if you use GIS to guide your redevelopment options.
As far as the GIS, although we had GIS maps for other parts of the cleanup, they were not used for the vision of the reuse. And the question right before that?
They wanted to know if you collaborated with land planners.
Oh, with land planners. Yes, it was the land planners for the township. It was really, you know, we put out the option of reusing the site, and we had many meetings with the township supervisors that actually decided. So they, you know, they were talking about different things. You know, at one time they were discussing using it for an outdoor hockey rink, and then they decided for the soccer fields and the baseball fields. We pretty much let the local township decide how they wanted to use the site. And there were some areas that were restricted where we had our groundwater treatment plant. But other than that, there was about 20 acres there that they pretty much designed themselves and used their own local planner.
Okay, great. I continue to see questions that came in online, and I think for the just for time right now, we're going to keep going on, and we will continue to queue the questions and have them available for the end of the presentation. So if you're submitting them online, don't worry. We see them, and we will continue to ask those once we get to the closeout today. So I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number 50. And we'll begin our next presentation.
Tom Bloom.
With Tom Bloom.
Hi, everybody. This is Tom Bloom in Region 5. I'm the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator, and today I'm going to talk about the Reed Kepler Park, which is located in West Chicago, Illinois. Next slide. A little bit about the site details and history. It's located in a residential area. It's about a 90-acre park. The park district originally purchased it from a railroad company in the 30s and developed it as a park. It included a small municipal landfill, about 1 acre, and that remained open until about 1974. Over the 40-year period of operation, radioactive mine tailings that were from the processes at the West Chicago Rare Earth Facility were used to cover as landfill, daily landfill cover, and also as fill material surrounding the park area. It was also, those radioactive mine tailings were also put all over the residential area. They were put in the sewage treatment plant and spread just about all over the west side of Chicago. At that time, they thought they were safe and okay for being used as fill. About 1978, they fenced the quarry, realizing that there was some contamination in there, low-level RAF contamination, and the site was put on the NPL, I think, in the 1990s, at least the Reed Kepler Park portion of it. Next slide. Okay, this is a picture of the rare earth facility. In 1993, we started an RIFS to determine the nature of an extent of contamination. We found that the criteria for a time-critical removal was there. We asked Kerr McGee to start an excavation work in April of 1993 at the time-critical removal, and they completed the excavation in late 1999. Right around that time, they restored the area with backfilling, grading, reseeding, and ground placement of groundwater monitoring wells and a road work network. Everything was done by about November of 2000. The groundwater monitoring was, they had a continued, it was like a natural attenuation type of groundwater remedy portion of the remedy. They had a monitor until about 2007, and they found at that time that there was no longer need for monitoring. There was no radioactivity being leached into the groundwater. Next slide. So what made this unusual, well, not unusual, but I mean there was already a park there, and the West Chicago Park District came to the RPM right when the RIFS started and said that they had money and they wanted to upgrade the park and they wanted to put it in this aquatic center, and could they do it? And at that time, I mean, the RPM could have said, no, we haven't determined the nature and extent of contamination yet. You know, it's just been put on the NPL, but he didn't. He said, well, we'll work with you, and we'll try to figure out where we know the contamination is, where we know the contamination isn't. We'll look at your plans for your aquatic center, and we'll modify those plans so that you can still go ahead with your project. And that's what they did. They modified part of the placement of the aquatic center. They also staged in part of the parking lot, where part of a parking lot for the aquatic center was put in an area that they knew wasn't contaminated, but then there was an expansion phase. Once we completed the removal action, that they expanded the parking lot larger and placed it over the area that had been clean. Let's see. In addition, let's go to the next slide. In addition to the aquatic center, which has a pool, water slides, sand volleyball courts, concession stands, and changing stations, There's in this 90-acre park, they put seven softball fields, a t-ball field, two soccer fields, a football field, small lacrosse field, two playgrounds, a dog park, skateboard park, nature sanctuary, 25-acre multi-use nature trail, and there's a partridge and a pear tree there, too. Next slide. I'm only kidding. Some of the interesting concerns were with the community and with stigma and with liability, and I wanted to kind of talk about those a little bit and how we address that. Some of the stigma concerns were not so much that the park was going to be reused and people were worried about having their children play on a formerly contaminated property, but the stigma was more towards when the excavation and the time-critical removal was happening. As trucks were rolling through the neighborhood, people were concerned about, you know, contamination falling off the trucks, about traffic patterns. And so by putting information in the local newspaper, encouraging residents to call EPA officials, putting together a bunch of fact sheets, we kind of destigmatized and we helped the city to destigmatize the Reed Kepler Park, showing people that it not only would be safe afterwards, but safe during the excavation and all. Next slide. And there's a picture of the Aquatic Center entrance. Next slide. There's a picture of a couple of softball fields. And the next slide. And there's a picture of the skate park. A couple of days ago, I got to talk to the RPM that actually did it, not the one that has it now, and I just asked them, what are some of the nuances that came into this that I could tell everybody in this webinar? Basically, nuances with stigma and with liability concerns, and also some of the innovative things that we did out there. One of the things that he brought up was, well, I have already brought up, was the fact that we wanted to work with the Park District to help this aquatic center be put into place, even though we hadn't fully determined the nature and extent of contamination. And I think that worked pretty well for community relations, at least with the park district and the owner of the property, because, you know, we didn't just put our heads in the sand and say, you got to come back to us when we finish our five-year-long RIFS. Also being able to modify the plan and move the plan around so that we put the aquatic center where we know that it was cleaned and also part of the parking lot that we knew where was clean, and then also phasing in a new part of the parking lot that we know was dirty, but that was going to be clean afterwards. During the excavation, EPA worked with the state to conduct oversight of the PRP removal action, and we kind of not televised that, but we made sure the community was aware of that. We put out our field notes and daily observations, address some of their comments about uncertainty. We also worked with the PRPs at that time to kind of define the uncertainty about the amounts of contamination that was out there, the cost of the removal action. And by doing that, by putting a process together, it enabled the PRPs to more accurately estimate the cleanup costs and the timeline, and that helped out tremendously because it dealt with some of the uncertainties that the PRPs had going into this removal action. Liability wasn't a great issue. There wasn't a developer that was necessarily picking up this property after we cleaned it up. So it was city owned, it was managed by the park, it was cleaned up by the PRP. We didn't have to worry too much about bona fide purchaser prospective purchaser agreements or anything like that. The RPM told me that community relations were very difficult at the beginning, and the reason why was because the plan called for disposal of radioactive mine tailings, not only from the residential cleanup area and from Reed Kepler Park, that all that waste was going to go to the facility that it then generated the radioactive waste, the rare earth facility. And the people in the neighborhood didn't really like that. They didn't like the idea that we were bringing more waste. They agreed with the closing of the rare earth facility in place and not shipping anything off, but they didn't like the idea that we were bringing more radioactive material and basically building a radioactive waste site by, you know, taking the residential soils and the Reed Kepler Park soils and putting them in the rare earths facility. We changed the proposed plan, and we changed it so that we would transport the soil contamination from the residential cleanup and from the Reed Kepler Park and from the sewage treatment facility to Utah, and I think they burnt it in the incinerator, and that helped with community relations dramatically. There are still some negative, you know, community issues regarding traffic patterns and your typical delays in the cleanup time and all like that, but for the most part, we got everybody on board after we changed the proposed plan and said we were going to dispose of all these radioactive mine tailings in the rare earth facility closed plan. Let's go to the next slide if there is one. Oh, that's it. So now I talked to the park district. There's several thousands of residents that annually visit this park with many major events. There really isn't a major concern for stigma or liability, and I think it was a win-win for everybody. It just took a long time and a lot of money. Okay, any questions?
I think we're going to move on to the next presentation just in the interest of time. So, again, if you're on the phone line, hang tight. We'll have time for Q&A at the end. But for those of you online streaming, go ahead and keep typing those questions. We are queuing them up. So I think we're on slide number 59.
And Rosemary.
And Rosemary, if you're ready to go.
Yes, I'm ready to go. You can hear me, right?
Yes, we can.
Okay, hi. I'm Rosemary Carraway, and I'm the project manager for the Pemaco Maywood site in Maywood, California. So if you go to the next slide, number 60, this is just an overview of what the plant looked like just before the removal action occurred in the early 90s. So the Pemaco site occupies a four-acre tract along the Los Angeles River in Maywood, California. It operated as a chemical mixing facility from the late 1940s until 1991. And the facility was closed in 1993 by a fire. So a fire destroyed the warehouse and raised some safety concerns. So at this particular facility, we had about 31 underground storage tanks, 6 above-ground storage tanks, and 400 drums that were on site. So if you go to 61, you can get an overview of what the site looked like. So on the right, as you're looking at that picture, the top of the picture is Slauson Boulevard, and then the right side kind of off the slide is kind of where the river is. And you can see some of the tanks on the left side at the bottom. So for the most part, they blended their chemicals, and they were delivered via rail. And you can see the rail on the left-hand side. In general, we saw chlorinated solvents there, and soil and groundwater contamination as a result of their usage. And the site was listed on the MPL in 1999. If you go to the next slide, 62, this is actually my favorite slide. It's from the removal action, and the guys are standing on the tanks. But it's part of that removal, and they had 31 tanks, and they were just laying side by side within their within the underground storage tank area. In general, the chemicals that we saw there were alcohols, xylene, toluene, acetone, and hexane. If you go to the next slide, you can see us doing the removal, and us taking down the plant and a couple of the underground storage tanks. And go to the next slide, 64. So in general, in 1997, we removed 29 underground storage tanks. We installed a soil vapor extraction system and treated about 144,000 pounds of soil in 1998 to 99. We started the RI in 2004, and then we were able to get to a ROD by 2005, and we signed it in early 2005 and included a lot of public comments. During this time frame, though, one of the things, if you can go to the next slide, 65, one of the things that was important about the Pemaco site was that when we started, or actually right after it got listed, the city was working with the Trust for Public Land, which is a local entity in California, about creating a park. So as you look at this particular slide, you can see Slauson Avenue, you can see Alamo Avenue on the left, 59th Place on the right, and then if you come down Walker Avenue, and you see where the Pemaco treatment plant is on the right-hand side. All of that was designated as park land. So the park was built out all the way up through, as you can see from this picture, to the ERH area, which is one of our treated areas for Pemaco. So I just put this here just to kind of show you where the boundaries are. So we worked with as we were working for reuse, we worked with the city, the Trust for Public Land. The Trust was in charge of purchasing all of the individual lots, so Pemaco was one of the lots. To the left of Pemaco, where you kind of see the soccer field, it was owned by another property or owner, W.W. Henry, who has his own cleanup system. So as we were going through the investigation, we were actually working on the design of the park, or the city was working on the design of the park, and we had separate meetings where we talked about the design. So if you go to slide 66, you can see just a real quick picture of us putting in some of our underground piping. So we began construction in August 3rd of 2005, and we ended up doing the scenario where we started construction with the city of Maywood, where the city of Maywood was raising land on the other parcels while we were actually putting in the underground pipe. And so we did a lot of coordination in order to get this to occur. And so if you go to slide 67, it's just an aerial of the whole area. Slauson would be kind of in the bottom of the slide, and you're kind of looking out. The building in the white is where 59th Street would have been in the previous slide. So this is just kind of looking at it. We placed a bunch of piping and trenches to take it back down to the treatment plant. Normally, we would have put an EPA treatment plant on the land of the Superfund site. We moved it in order for park construction to occur. And if you go to the next slide, another overview, and then 69. During 2006, we actually started the building of our foundation for our treatment plant. So this is just an overview of the treatment plant in February 20th of 2007. At the top of the treatment plant, we kind of see that little white hook. I think you can see a little bit of water there, but anyway, that's where the LA River. LA River is kind of is a misnomer. It's kind of a concrete thing that has water in it, but
we designated
it a river, so it is a river. So our treatment, if you go to 70. This is just another overview of the construction that was going on at the Pemaco facility itself or the portions that we didn't build out. And we put in an innovative remedy here, at least at the time it was, electrical resistive heating. So we put electrodes in the ground and we heated the subsurface to basically boil out the chemicals that were in the subsurface. So if you go to slide 71, we also did something else that's a little bit different than we were working on green remediation at the time, and someone here in the office was working on it and asked me if we would consider doing some green remediation. At the time, we couldn't do work associated with maybe the trucks and making sure that the trucks didn't have the various things that they needed to make sure that we weren't releasing, but I could work on doing something to the treatment plant. So that's a solar array that's on the treatment plant. We could only put it on one side of the roof, though, because at the time we had already ordered the building. So we were able to actually support that one side of the roof. So it's a 3.4 kilowatt solar system. It was installed on July 3rd of 2007. It produces about 5,600 kilowatts per year, and it's offset by about 3.3 tons of CO2 per year. So it's equal to saving about 2.5 acre trees and 7,600 car miles. So it's not as big as the Aerojet facility. And I think this, if you look at this one, this is probably equivalent to what you would put on one of your homes. But at the time, it was enough for us to kind of feed in a little bit of solar energy into the treatment plant. And it saves us some money. And so if you go to 72, this is just showing some of the cleanup activities or the construction of the park during the summer of 2006. So as you can see, the city started putting up some of the infrastructure for the kids' playground. In the background, you can see some of the neighborhood homes. And then if you go to slide 73, that's our conceptual design. So we actually started out, the city had hired their own contractor to actually implement the park. So in our meetings, we would look at some of their designs. So this is showing the conceptual design that we worked with. If you look at the bottom right-hand corner, the original, where there's a sign for restrooms on the right, and then left of that is kind of where we still are working on on treatment, and we're going to take that out in the next 6 months or so and give it back to the city. At the time, they were going to put a mound in there, kind of a soil mountain, kind of moundy kind of thing, but it turns out that the play field or the soccer field are turning out to be very, very busy things for the community, and so they're asking for more soccer fields. So they're going to change that design a little bit, so we're going to have to talk about how that's going to work. And then, so if you go to 74, just again, we worked with a number of agencies to help facilitate this between 1998 and 2005. The park was completed during May of 2006. There was a kind of takeover of, how do I put this, be diplomatic too, of, I don't know, it's kind of like the city changed hands with some of their folks who got voted in. So the opening of the park actually got delayed about a year until 2007 just because folks were concerned about what we had done before then. And they had marketed themselves as trying to fix the EPA problem. So one of the things that could come up is you're working on this revitalization issue and then some things could change in the city that could change kind of where you were intending to go. So if you go to slide 75, it's still a needed area for the city of Maywood. It's only the second park for the city residents, and that city is very, very dense. We did work with the city council to codify institutional controls, so the area and site is identified as a recreational use, and no changes to the land can occur without the city notifying EPA. So in general, it stays as a park, and as we work for helping them revitalize the last part of it, we'll work with them on some design issues. So what I also, I put a few extra slides in just to kind of show you kind of the park. So we'll just quickly go through those and I'll probably be done. So 76, just saying it's an integral part. So if we go to 77, this is an overview of the park before we put the fence up and started doing the ERH or the electric resistive heating area. So that right area here is a swale, so that was kind of closer to where some of the underground storage tanks were. You can also see that we have our monitoring wells are still in the park, and so you can see how we're kind of still putting them in the grassy area, but they're still part of the park landscape. And then if you go to 78, this is up at the river, and it's looking down towards soil piles. The soil piles that are there were purchased by the city so they can build that mound or their little mountain, and now they've decided they don't want the mountain, so they're going to have to figure out what to do with some of their clean soil. And then 79, again, a picture of the kids in the park area. And then I think 80. It's just an overview of the project. We were able to get a really good photographer to give us kind of an aerial view from the top of Pemico looking back towards the park in June of 2006. And then 81 is kind of the little fence that goes into the park area. And then I think I have one more or a couple more just overviews. So I think we can go, again, in terms of what's in the park, let's go to 84 just as in general. What's in the park are soccer fields. We have playgrounds. There are handball courts, basketball courts, and there's an access pathway to the LA River Park. For those of you who pick up the slides later, what I also did at the end is in slides 86 through 93, I just provided some slides that show you how the groundwater plume has changed over time or how it's been reduced over time as we've cleaned up at the treatment plant. So I just wanted those so you can have them as access. So if I'm done with talking, and I can take some questions if you like, and we can move to the new talk starts on slide 95.
Okay. Thank you, Rosemary. Did anybody have questions for Rosemary? You want to?
Again, if you're on the phone lines and you have questions, you can take yourself off of mute by hitting #6. Okay, we do have one electronic question that came in online. We'll go through this one and then we'll move on. So the question that was submitted electronically in your talk, Rosemary, they asked, Does EPA have default exposure assumptions for assessing the risks of recreational users? If not, how are the health risks determined at these sites to make sure that the public is protected?
What we did was we actually, for Pemaco, we actually looked at residential as the default for cleanup. So the Pemaco site went to residential standards. Now, the other thing that came on board was because the other parcels were being purchased by someone else, we had them being monitored under a different scenario. They were being monitored under a state scenario. So the state, under the state documentation, they still did a risk assessment, and what we had was our risk assessor from the EPA risk assessor actually reviewed their documentation. So we ended up with, I think, a very good or probably they ended up with a cleanup standard that was probably a little bit more stringent than maybe they normally would have had, but at the same time it took into account both the fact that there was a Superfund site there as well as the other lands.
Okay, great. We have another question that came in as well, and they asked what type of liner was used on the site.
Oh, gosh, do I remember? I know that it's 2 feet. We have a 2 feet cover with a, I'm thinking polypropylene, but I could be totally wrong. So how about I promise to answer that question via email?
Sounds great.
Don't okay, remember great. The type.
We'll get that email question to you, Rosemary.
Okay,
so I believe we are continuing on the presentation with slide number 95.
Okay. I want to thank you all for those great stories, and I'd like to just conclude by offering a number of tools that SRI provides for getting started with reuse. Next slide. We have a great range of support tools and resources available that can support what we like to think of as smart growth-related outcomes, and our website provides information about all of these. And because we don't have much time left, I'll just talk briefly about a few of them. So next slide. With our SRI website, communication is the key, I think, for all of reuse, and SRI's website is the hub for most of our reuse support tools. And in addition to hosting fact sheets and case studies, our website hosts SRI's series of reuse videos and additional information and reuse-related resources. If a site has been successfully reused, we really want to make sure that that story is available as a resource for others who are working to return sites to reuse. And to spread the word, we've developed fact sheets, case studies, videos, brochures, and we regularly update our SRI website. So if you want more information about the things we talked about today, I seriously suggest you go take a look. Next slide. The Return to Use Initiative is currently one of our primary efforts, and it's focused on construction complete sites or sites that are partly cleaned up, and it has one major purpose, and that's to remove barriers to reuse that aren't necessary for the protection of human health, the environment, or the remedy at those sites where remedies are already in place. And as part of this initiative, we capture the lessons learned at the site and create demonstration projects so other cleanup sites can benefit from the experiences. We also make an effort to do what we can to address the barriers and work with the regions to find out ways headquarters could potentially help on a site-by-site basis. So some examples are providing regional seed resources, identifying and sharing examples that promote lessons learned, and helping regions draft ready for reuse determinations. Next slide. We also do a lot of reuse planning. And through our community support pilot projects, we provide startup funding for reuse planning at Superfund sites. And I just want to take a few minutes to explain this process in more detail over the next couple of slides. But displayed on this slide are maps and photographs from the reuse plan from the Bandera Road Superfund site, which is located in Leon Valley near San Antonio, Texas. And maps like these are instrumental in helping communities and EPA determine a site's reasonably anticipated future land use. Next slide. Okay. So for community support, there are a lot of benefits. And to initiate planning projects, we provide startup reuse planning funds to communities around the country. And through this work, we've seen that well-run community-based reuse planning has the potential to dramatically improve community relations and the public's perception of the agencies, and it can streamline the cleanup process by clarifying a site's reasonably anticipated future land use and integrating that information with the site's cleanup plan. And it also brings agency and communities together around more cost-effective remedies that produce the greatest long-term value for local communities. So one of the things we do is we support something called Regional Seeds, which are resources provided by SRI to communities at the request of EPA regional offices. And the seed concept provides an initial investment that brings stakeholders to the table. It clarifies remedy constraints, and it outlines suitable reuse options for a local community to pursue. Additional resources to complete the reuse planning process are provided by each region. And as a reuse planning process gains momentum, communities can leverage the initial regional seed investment with local resources to continue the process of returning a local Superfund site to productive use. So we recognize that there is no one-size-fits-all strategy to make reuse happen, so we have several different types of community support resources to support reuse. Next slide. And one of these tools is something that we've talked a little bit about, which is a Ready for Reuse Determination, and they're an environmental status report that says in plain English the uses that a site can support and the limitations on reuse. And local governments have found them especially useful because they're a tool that they can share with the community at large, and it reassures everyone that EPA acknowledges that a site is ready to be returned to use. And if you think a tool that answers that question on this slide might be useful, be sure to talk to us. Just as an aside, we invented Ready for Reuse Determinations because the financial community said, there's so much information on these sites. How are we supposed to know what's good, what's bad, and how do we maneuver? And although we did this for the finance community, we found it was much more beneficial for state and local governments to show communities. Next slide. Finally, each region has what we call a Superfund redevelopment coordinator, and I hope you'll, with your questions, they'll contact those people. Many of the regional coordinators are on the phone, and I just want to say finally that I really appreciate the stories that everyone has told and the sharing that we've done. As I say, we never think we're getting to the end of reuse. We're constantly surprised by what might happen or what kind of reuse someone can come up with. So we encourage you to go forth and think about reuse very seriously, and we hope that this webinar has been helpful to you in giving you information on how reuse works in the areas of recreation. And I think that now we can go to our questions.
Yes.
Okay.
So for those of you who are on the phone lines, I'm going to come to you guys in just a moment. And for those of you streaming audio, I want you to continue to click that question mark button and type in your questions. We do have questions that were submitted at the start of the session, and we have them queued up. So I'm going to start with a few of the questions that came in online and then kind of switch over to the phone lines, and then we'll go back to the online questions. So I'm going to start with a question that came in from Madison, Wisconsin, and I believe this was directed for our very first site.
Yes, Bill and Richard.
Bill and Richard. This question asks, does the Vista View Park have an active landfill gas system?
I can answer that, Richard Myers. Actually, no. We had recently been approved through the state to remove our landfill gas collection control system, an active system that was in place from approximately 1994 through 2010. So for 16 years it was in place, and it was only in place on the municipal solid waste landfill, the North Mound, but we were able to get approval to remove that recently.
Great, thank you.
I think that next question is for Chris.
Right, the next, I think I've got two or three questions that are now coming in for the site in Region 3.
Whitmore Labs.
Yeah, Whitmore Labs. Chris Corbett, I think these questions are directed at you. So the first question is asking, do you implement an ICP, Institutional Controls Program, to manage cleaned up areas?
Yeah, the way we, this was, the ICs were put in place before we had the guidance for an ICP, and the way the PRPs did the ICs for this site, which I thought was a good way to do it, was through the Pennsylvania One Call program. Similar to when you're doing a drilling activity and you have to contact to see where the subsurface gas lines are and electric lines, what the PRP did was they registered the entire site with Pennsylvania One Call, so that a flag would go up that you cannot do any excavation work throughout the whole site because there's just a 2-foot soil cover. So that's how the IC for to protect disturbance of the cover material was taken into account.
Okay, great. The next question asks you, what specifically was the contribution from the U.S. Soccer Foundation? What type or kind of activities do they normally fund?
Well, on other sites in our region here, they were actually heavily involved in the Avtec site, which I don't have a whole lot of information about, but I know they worked with them for several years, and at one time, I think they were even funding the installation of soccer fields. On this site at Whitmore, we just had them come out and look at our grading plans. One of the concerns that we had was because we had to have proper drainage and that the fields were, what they said, crowned. You know, there was that was slightly elevated in the center. We wanted to make sure that even these slight slopes would be acceptable for playing soccer and it wouldn't be dangerous where kids would, you know, twist an ankle. So they looked specifically at that.
Okay, great. We also have one more question for you, Chris, and this one is asking if your groundwater treatment, or do you have a groundwater treatment system on site?
Yes, we do. It's actually quite a massive groundwater treatment system because the plume was pretty large. And if I could just give a plug for green remediation, one of the things we came up with for this site was to use the waste material from the steel industry. It's a material called pickle liquor. And what it is, it's basically hydrochloric acid that's very high in iron. To treat the steel, they spray it with this acid, and as a result, it has a high iron content. So they bring in this waste material by tanker every month or two, and they use that in the treatment. And the arsenic binds with the iron, and even though we have a high concentration of arsenic in the sludge, it is bound so tight it comes out to be non-hazardous, which is a big plus. So we have a little green remediation going on here as well.
Excellent. We have a question that came in. I believe, Rosemary, this question is directed at you, and they're labeling it as a follow-up question. And they ask, should residential standards be used for all recreational land uses, or does EPA allow less stringent standards on a site-specific basis?
I think we've been moving towards site use, like what the actual anticipated use is. But on this particular site, because of the way we started out, we did EPA's default, which is to residential. I don't know if I answered the question. I can probably. I think you should use the appropriate one.
Okay.
But remembering that EPA's default is residential.
Okay. The next question I have online is actually directed at all of the presenters, and they ask, have any of the projects used or utilized a public involvement plan using the, quote, Institute for Participatory Management and Planning by Hans Bleicher?
I can answer that real quick for me, no.
Okay.
But on the other hand, I mean, what I didn't mention, honestly, is we started out in 1997 with extensive community meetings throughout the RI, much more than I normally would do. I mean, if you look at our normal process, we might do one or two meetings before we get to that, you know, that proposed plan scenario. But this project, we had meetings 2, 3, 4 times a year, if not more often. So I haven't heard of his that particular item, but I just know from our perspective, we actually did a lot more community outreach than we normally would have done.
Okay. Anyone else?
Yeah, Tom Bloom in Region 5, no, we did not use his plan.
I just want to add, we may not have used that specific plan, but we do have a very extensive public participation process, and that our reuse planning seeks to find diverse stakeholders and pull them all together and figure out what to do. And in that process of getting together our stakeholders and planning for site reuse, we do get a lot of involvement, I think, that we traditionally and typically would not have.
Okay, great. Again, if you're online and you have an online question, take a second to type it up very quickly. And while we wait to see if you have any more online questions, I'll switch over to the phone line participants. If you're on the phones and you have a question, I did globally mute all the lines. So if you'd like to ask a question out loud, please hit #6 on your phone and identify yourself or your organization, and feel free to ask a question or make a comment.
Hey, this is Tom Bloom. I've got one for Rosemary.
Go ahead.
On your project, when you did your melt, did you have to put a hood over that to catch the off gases?
I'm sorry, when I did my what?
When you did your in-situ vitrification, when you...
Oh, okay. You mean my electrical resistive heating?
Yeah.
No, we
is
were
that
okay.
The same, is
our
that
heating
the same?
Started from 35 feet below ground surface to 95 feet. So the heating itself, there was a 35-foot, if you will, soil area that was not heated between the surface and 35 feet down.
I see. So you didn't have to worry about fatal zone vapors getting into the ambient air.
No, everything was caught in the piping. I mean, we still collected it in the pipelines that you saw, either vapor lines or water lines, but no, we didn't have to worry about it going up into the air.
Okay, thanks.
Huh? Any other questions or comments by phone? Okay, I don't see any other online questions coming in, so Melissa?
All right. Thank you very much for joining us today, and I want to give a special thanks to my panelists, Bill Denman, Richard Myers, Chris Corbett, Tom Bloom, and Rosemary Caraway. And I think you all did a terrific job, and I am sure that in the ethos sphere, people are clapping. So thank you all very much.
So with that, I'm going to direct everyone on to the final slide in today's presentation materials, which is slide number 105. And on slide number 105, you'll find two links that I mentioned when we started today's Internet seminar. The first one is a link to the additional resources page, where not only can you download a copy of today's presentation material, but you'll also find the link to the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative homepage, and you'll see other resources that we've collected relative to our presentations today. So I'd highly encourage you guys to take a moment to take a look at the resource page. The other link that you'll find is a link to our feedback form. It is a short form. It takes about a minute or two to fill that out, and please know I do read each and every one of the responses we receive. So we would ask if you take just a minute to fill that out and let us know what you thought of today's session. It's incredibly important to give us your feedback if you'd like to continue to receive free online training like this through Cluin. If you're looking for verification or confirmation of your participation today, when you fill out that feedback form, there's a box you can check to actually have an email confirmation message sent to you that verifies you submitted feedback at a particular time. If you're sharing the line or computer with multiple participants, after each person submits their feedback, there will be a link to let someone else hop on the computer and fill out their own form and get their own confirmation message. And please be aware, if you can't fill out those forms now or you're looking at print copies and materials, both of these links are available at the bottom of the seminar homepage, which will continue to remain active beyond the end date of our session today. And we had one last question that managed to sneak in online. And since we still have time, I'm going to go ahead and throw that out there. This question is coming in from Indianapolis, and they ask, did any of the case studies presented today use non-residential criteria for closure or redevelopment? If so, what exposure parameters were used? So that applies to all of the presenters. Did any of the presenters use non-residential criteria?
Tom Bloom, no. It was residential cleanup.
Rosemary, no. Residential cleanup. Okay.
Yeah, this is Chris in Region 3. Our arsenic cleanup number was actually based upon background at 21 parts per million. I think that probably is outside of the residential cleanup.
Okay.
And Richard Myers with the Davie landfill, it's difficult to say. The cleanup for the sludge lagoon was done such a long time ago. From that perspective, I know that it met fairly stringent cleanup requirements, and the rest of the landfill was capped as a landfill normally would be. So those controls were in place and didn't require, obviously, any further cleanup other than the sludge lagoon.
Right. And, Richard, this is Bill. I would add that the sludge lagoon that was cleaned up is now underwater, right? I mean, I think that area that was excavated for the sludge lagoon is now part of one of the lakes.
It is, and we call it a nature pond, and it really does resemble a very natural wetland type of area. So, yes.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you all so much for taking that last question. So, I want to echo Melissa's thanks to all the presenters who joined us today. I also want to thank the over 120 individuals who joined us from around the country to listen in on today's Kluwen Internet Seminar, which is part of the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative seminar series that they've been hosting on Kluwen for some time now. As a reminder, today's session was recorded. It'll take us about 1 to 2 weeks, but you will automatically receive an archive email as soon as that recording is available for free replay and download. So again, I want to thank you all for joining us and hope that you will continue to join us in the future for another Kluwen seminar. This will represent the official conclusion for today's session. I hope you all have a great rest of your day. Thanks so much. Take care.